各位观众大家好，我是卡拉，欢迎收看美国观察。众议院议长佩洛西开启亚洲之行，周一第一站在新加坡会晤李显龙。美国和台湾媒体报道说，佩洛西可能于周二访问台湾并过夜。今天的节目中我们共同关注。美国国会众议院议长佩洛西星期一率国会代表团抵达新加坡，开始对亚洲多国的访问。佩洛西与新加坡总理李显龙会面，谈到乌克兰战争、台海局势、气候变化等议题。佩洛西也与多位新加坡内阁成员进行会面。CNN 引述不具名台湾高层官员的话说，佩洛西不仅将访问台湾，而且会在台湾过夜。美国官方并未证实这个消息。此前，中国对佩洛西可能访台表达强烈的反对立场，并威胁说，这将导致非常严重的事态和后果。美国国务卿布林肯周一表示，佩洛西议长是否访问台湾将完全是他自己的决定。他呼吁中国不要采取加剧紧张局势的动作。
The Speaker will make her own decisions about whether or not to visit Taiwan. Congress is an independent, co-equal branch of government. The decision is entirely the Speaker's. What I can say is this. This is very much precedent in the sense that previous speakers visited Taiwan. Many members of Congress go to Taiwan, including this year. And so if the Speaker does decide to visit and China tries to create some kind of crisis or otherwise escalate tensions, that would be entirely on Beijing. We are looking for them in the event she decides to visit. To act responsibly and not to engage in any escalation going forward.
在周一的白宫记者会上，美国国家安全委员会发言人科比说，众议院议长有权访问台湾。美国议长访台并非第一次。如果佩洛西真的决定访台，并不意味着美国在改变现状。
I want to reaffirm that the speaker has not confirmed.Any travel plans, and it is for the speaker to do so and her staff. So we won't be commenting or speculating about the stops on her trip. We have been clear from the very beginning that she will make her own decisions and that Congress is an independent branch of government. Our Constitution embeds the separation of powers. This is well known to the PRC, given our more than four decades of diplomatic relations.The Speaker has the right to visit Taiwan, and the Speaker of the House has visited Taiwan before without incident, as have many members of Congress, including this year. Now, the world has seen the United States government be very clear that nothing has changed, nothing has changed about our One China policy, which is, of course, guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three joint U.S.-PRC communiques, and the six assurances that if she goes, if she goes,It's not without precedent. It's not new. It doesn't change anything. I mean, what we would hope they infer from everything we've done and everything we've said, including during the president's phone call, is that we're being consistent. There's no change. We've not ramped up the rhetoric. We've not changed our behavior. Everything we've done is consistent with our obligations and our commitments.
佩洛西议长和国会代表团周一访问新加坡后，还将访问马来西亚、韩国和日本。佩洛西议长可能访台，中国方面多次进行威胁，台海形势愈发敏感。中国目前的军力达到了怎样的水平？面对中国迅速扩展军事存在，美国要如何回应？新加坡南洋理工大学防务与战略研究所研究员高瑞莲分享了他的看法。
Recently, China's MOFA claimed that the Taiwan Strait is not international waters, and Xi Jinping signed into law the power to conduct military operations other than war, which to many sounds very much like what Russia is doing to Ukraine now. So what do you think? What is Beijing's calculus behind all these notions? And do you think Beijing would mimic what Russia has done to Ukraine?
We have to understand that for China, this has come quite a long way. If you recall a number of years back, when Chinese expatriates found themselves under danger overseas, for example, in Pakistan in the recent years, Chinese nationals have been targeted in the various terrorist attacks in Pakistan, especially those that were connected the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor Project, and after which the Chinese authorities had already started talking about conducting operations other than war overseas. And thereby, that also means, you know, just recently, I think that was around late last year or so, the Chinese government amended their national law, the law on national defense, and that definitely included the use of military force in protection of so-called developmental rights, which is something that is new to the amendment to the law of national defense. So I think if we look at the current context of the new directive that was signed by Chairman Xi Jinping, I think it's clear that there is a natural progression from the previous developments. However, of course, you know, if China wanted to use, you know, so-called operations other than war to describe its operation against Taiwan, then I think more accurately, we could think about operations that lie more in the gray zone dimension. Gray zone activities that allow the Chinese to actually use force to a limited extent to achieve limited objectives in the Taiwan Strait without necessarily resorting to full-scale conflict, which obviously will go outside the ambit of operations other than war itself. So I don't think the Chinese were trying to emulate what the Russians were doing in the case of so-called naming their invasion of Ukraine as a special military operation. I don't think that is the intention. I think the Chinese were more straightforward in describing whatever the operations the PLA will undertake in that sense.
But how high do you think the risk is for China to take military actions over Taiwan? Mm. Because all these actions, it sounds an alarm to Western countries, also, of course, to Taiwan, all this Ukraine war. And also what Wei Fenghe, the Chinese defense minister, said at the Shangri-La Forum, he said, you know, China is willing to go to war under certain circumstances. That sounds an alarm to the international community. How high do you think the risk is now?
I think as for now, the likelihood doesn't at least appear to be high compared to before the Ukraine crisis, for a very simple reason that the PLA has been trying to emulate the Russian military for many years. Because, you know, being short of given the opportunity to examine and to learn upfront, you know, Western military practices, the Russian military has provided, you know, the key learning points for the PLA. We saw before the Ukraine crisis in the recent years, the PLA had engaged in a number of joint exercises with the Russians with the express intention to try to extract, you know, good lessons from Russia. But if anything, the initial phases of the Ukraine war, especially the phases surrounding Kiev, you know, where Russia actually found itself underperforming to beyond within expectation, you know, is somewhat would have prompted the Chinese to rethink, you know, whether they should actually push forward if it is really the case, you know, any plans for Taiwan invasion, or at the very least, whatever invasion plans they have in the drawer right now will have to be taken out and have to be taken apart, and thereby they have to draw lessons from the Ukraine war and use that to revise their invasion plan, which means this will require some time for them. And in any case, it appears that because the war is dragging on, it will take a longer time for the PLA to draw the full lessons. And those lessons are not necessarily just military. It also involves strategic lessons. I believe Beijing will be interested to see how Russia's economy holds up against the unprecedented sanctions and use that as a way to gauge the potential reactions from the international community in the conduct of any Taiwan Strait invasion, in a sense. But that being the case, it's clear that the PLA modernization has reached a point where they have accumulated more or less the necessary tools to conduct the invasion in that regard. So I think it is therefore, you know, not a wise thing to discount the likelihood of gray zone operations that China will be conducting to gradually erode or undermine Taiwanese ability or will to defend itself or safeguard itself during this dangerous period.
If I ask, like, how much time does it take for them to be ready? 5, 10 years?
Well, I don't think I'm in the position to give a ballpark figure, but if we have to really beggar an estimation, 10 years, 5 to 10 years or so, it will require them to really train up. Because right now, if anything, the timetable could be shrunk further because, you know, all this training and all the indoctrination will be hastened if they have the right tools at their disposal. And right now, of course, the PI modernization has, you know, started with hardware and software modernization, which thereby means that right now they have some of those necessary tools in place that allow them to evaluate and test out those concepts. They need to experiment those concepts. So that will require at least 5 years, if I could put a rough figure on that. And barring any potential disturbances along the way, I think 5 years will be safe to imagine, of course, and it might potentially put the PLA on the timetable to become a strong military by 2030 or so. So I think that time frame is more or less correct. But, you know, an invasion of Taiwan within the next 2 years, I don't think that's likely. I think it will require the PLA to take a little bit longer to evaluate the lessons from Ukraine and thereby adapt them adequately. They need to experiment them, test them out, and thereby, you know, validate those concepts before they could put them into real application in a war scenario.
What about for Taiwan, right? What are some most urgent things if you give them 5 years or 10 years, right? What about for Taiwan? What are some most urgent things Taiwan needs to do to beef up its defense?
Wow, this is a very complex question. I have many responses to that. I think one is certainly to ensure that notwithstanding which political party takes control of the government, there must be consistent defense spending and investment. I think that is a very important task. And that investment takes into account both, you know, the day-to-day routine operations as well as to further modernize the Taiwanese military. As far as what we saw today, given the PLA flybys and, you know, sail pass, you know, around Taiwan that has become more regular these days, it does strain the existing Taiwanese forces. We're talking about existing machines as well as existing limited manpower. And that is reflected in the recent mishaps by the ROC Air Force. I think that somewhat reflects the age of the Air Force and the amount of strain put on manpower as well as machine. So that investment is already critical to upkeep these operations on the daily basis against Chinese intrusions into the air defense identification zone, for example. And what more to talk about investments into new capabilities. So I think that is the first part. The second, of course, I believe Taiwan does need to overhaul its military command and control structure. I think that is largely based on very old command and control structure that dated back to the Kuomintang, Chiang Kai-shek's era. I think that military command and control structure needs to be revamped. Yeah, it needs to be more modernized. There needs to be more emphasis on non-commissioned officers instead of just officers. So I think that is the second area. The third area is something that the Taiwanese military has been embarking in the recent years, which is on their missile capabilities. Because if anything, the current defense strategy that puts emphasis on asymmetric responses to China's invasion and or other scenario shouldn't, you know, prejudice the idea that you need to have what we call deterrence by punishment, meaning you need to have the right capabilities to impose higher costs on the aggressor. In that sense, we are talking about long-range missile systems, which is something that I believe the Taiwan Ministry of National Defense has been investing. So that requires consistent investments in that regard. And the final thing that I thought is necessary is certainly to improve the welfare of soldiers. I think that is something that has sort of emerged over time in Taiwan about, you know, inconsistent or poorly managed welfare for soldiers. We're talking about rank and file. There were, you know, reports about, you know, abuse of authority and you know, other instances where, you know, soldiers were not treated properly. And that has an impact on morale. I mean, if you're talking about wartime, morale is important. And what we saw in the case of Ukraine is that you wouldn't just, you know, need, you know, the right tools to fight. You need to have the right morale to fight. And the Ukrainian defenders have held up for these many months. It is in large part due to high morale amongst the defenders. So I think this is a lesson that the Taiwanese military would need to draw from in their preparation for potential conflict in the Taiwan Strait.
China just launched its third and most advanced aircraft carrier. How much does that enhance China's power production, projection capabilities, and how does that change the dynamics in the South China Sea and the East China Sea?
This goes down to the very technical specifications of the carrier itself. It is unlike the Liaoning and the Shandong. The Liaoning and Shandong were actually configured for ski jump. And you can see the angle of flight deck is very clear. The problem with ski jump, because it was in the absence of a conventional takeoff mechanism or a catapult, right? That a ski jump does impose physical limitations on a few technical aspects. One of which being that any jet fighter that needs to take off from a ski jump cannot take off with a full load. And that limits the combat effectiveness or potential of the aircraft in question, right? And ski jump also does impose limitations on the number of aircraft that could be launched at any one point of time as well. There are clear limitations on that. And the other thing that is of interest here is that this new carrier is comparable in size to the latest American carrier, which belongs to the Ford class. So they're comparable in size. And it means that the new carrier, Fujian, is able to carry a larger aviation complement. At the same time, they use conventional and electromagnetic catapult and takeoff system, which thereby means they could increase the turnaround rate for aircraft, meaning aircraft that they launch, they recover, and then they'll do refueling, rearming, and then they'll send them back to combat. This turnaround factor is important in any fluid naval warfare. And that is well highlighted in the previous wars we saw. For example, the Battle of Midway back in the Second World War. These are important factors to consider for the generation of combat power in any naval campaign. So that means, essentially, with this new carrier, it has served as somewhat, I call, a game changer for the PLA Navy. It actually allows the PLA Navy to further revisit and to revise its carrier operating doctrine. It actually allows China to actually, you know, embark on more complex joint operations and exercises together, not just within the PLA Navy itself, but also in conjunction with other PLA services to achieve jointness. So that is, you know, what I would see as, you know, potential boost to China's force projection capabilities. And that isn't just only the case, because most people focus on the carrier itself. But most people may actually overlook the fact that the PLA Navy in the recent years have been commissioning a many new surface combatants, as well as new fleet replenishment vessels. These are important in the formation of a carrier strike group or battle group. So it's not just a carrier itself. So these developments are also equally important. So going forward, we are going to see the PLA Navy further increase the number of carrier battle groups that it could fill. At the same time, given the new carrier that is entering service not long later, it will allow the PLA Navy to further refine its carrier doctrine and capabilities.
Given that China is expanding its military powers so much and so rapidly, and expanding its presence in the region, what should the U.S. do in response?
But going forward, the more sustainable way, which I believe the U.S. could do to offset the growing PLA military capabilities, would be to continue to put more emphasis on its existing network of security allies and partners. I think that is certainly a theme that the Biden administration has put front and center for its policy. But going forward, it will only mean that this is going to be increasingly more important, right? It will require the U.S. military to promote deeper and better interoperability with its, you know, foreign military counterparts in the Indo-Pacific. It will require, you know, more cooperation in, for example, you know, defense industrial aspects. It will require, for example, more exchanges between the military establishment and to come up with new alternatives to deal with, you know, the ongoing evolving landscape, especially when it comes to gray zone, for example. I think that is something that, you know, the U.S. and its regional allies and partners ought to be, you know, focused in looking at.
白宫经济顾问伯恩斯坦接受美国之音专访，谈到了美联储加息与经济衰退和通货膨胀的关系，以及中国关税的议题。来看详细内容。
First of all, thank you very much for talking with us, with VOA. I would like to start, well, of course, with the Fed decision. So the Fed just announced the 75 base point interest rate hike. This is the fourth rate hike since March. We know the White House has been telling us that consumer spending is still good, the jobs still growing in the past 3 months, so we are not heading to a recession. But Secretary Yellen also admitted the economy is cooling down. How effective do you estimate this rate hike potentially have more to come to provide a soft landing but not leading us into recession?
What the Federal Reserve is doing here is aggressively attacking a problem that President Biden addresses every time he talks about the economy, and that is the unacceptably high level of consumer inflation. We know the Fed has pivoted to aggressive rate hikes to dampen these price pressures, and the president has every faith in their ability to do so. In fact, he reappointed Chair Powell, who was then confirmed by Congress, so that's a pretty solid endorsement of his faith in the chair. The other thing that we do here at the White House, given the president's guidance, is really respect the Fed's independence. If you look at the history of Federal Reserves when they're in rate hiking cycles like they are now, that is raising interest rates, presidents have sometimes gotten up in their grill, as it were, and tried to get them to do less of that. Certainly our predecessor, President Trump, did that. We don't mess with their knitting that way. We have a lot of respect for their independence and understand that they are the first and foremost inflation-fighting institution in the economy.
Well, meanwhile, as, you know, respecting the Fed's independence, the White House prepare for possibly leading to a recession, and how would you tackle that if that leads to that?
What we're trying to do is follow the president's, again, his dispatch to his economics team, which is do everything we can to address his number one economic priority, and that's bringing down inflation. So all that we're doing is toward that goal. So for example, a few months ago, the president oversaw the release of 180 million barrels of oil from our strategic reserves. That's an oil reserve that the nation holds. He organized some of our global partners to add 60 million barrels to that. Thus far, over 120 million barrels of oil have come out of the strategic reserve, and our Energy Department just announced another 20 million coming into the market. Now, look, energy is a global price, but there's no question that that release is one of the reasons why gas prices have fallen steeply over the past 40 days or so, down over 70 cents a gallon from their peak. Now, at $4, at $4.30 nationally, per gallon, that's still too high. I don't want to oversell this, but nobody's taking a victory lap here. That's still too high. But if you're a family with a couple of drivers, that's a savings of $60 a month. If you aggregate that over the population, that's about $260 million per day in savings. That's a little bit of breathing room, and this president's fingerprints are on that. It's one of the kind of actions that I'm talking about in this context.
Yes, Chairman Powell actually just said it today, just a couple of minutes ago, said inflation is much too high. So, of course, we know that, like you mentioned, you know, it's be caused by a supply chain disruption, global COVID shutdown, and the war in Ukraine. So, but right now we are seeing the war will probably continue for a while. Besides the COVID, right now we are seeing global health threat, the monkeypox is coming up. Has the White House prepared for the inflation might continue to rise, especially we're seeing China has a zero COVID policy, resulting in a lot of business shutdown. What are the tools you have to tackle maybe future inflation continue to rise?
Yeah, this is an important question. There's a lot of uncertainty out here. You know, I've talked to you about the decline in the gas price. But that, given the uncertainties you mentioned, particularly the war in Ukraine, that could reverse. We know that Putin, in his unjust and vicious attack on the sovereign nation of Ukraine has weaponized the use of energy, particularly with Europe. So all those uncertainties are in the mix. What we have to do is keep our head down and try to implement the policies that President Biden is guiding us forward on. Now, I talked about the release of oil to help make sure that we have an adequate supply there. Another effort, which relates directly to your question, is working with our G7 partners to put a cap on the price of Russian oil. This is an initiative that, to cut to the chase, would keep Russian oil on the market. So it would maintain the stability of the supply of oil while depriving Putin of the revenues he needs to prosecute his unjust and illegal war. That's another policy that we're working on with G7 partners. With the Congress, we're trying to get lower prescription drug costs for Americans. Do you know that Americans, particularly our seniors, pay 2 to 3 times more for prescription drugs than people in other countries for the same prescription drug, for the same pill? That's because we have these foolish laws that are very much in support of big pharma, but not in support of American families, that prohibit Medicare for negotiating for lower prices. The president wants to take that off the table and make sure that Medicare can negotiate, stop doing big favors to big pharma, and start seeing big price relief for American seniors.
Yes, Ms. Franson, next I want to, talking about American family reliefs, will some of the, relief from the tariff of the Chinese goods be helpful for U.S. consumers?
Our trade negotiator, Catherine Tai, she runs our she's our United States trade representative, have talked about those tariffs in terms of leverage in dealing with a competitor that doesn't always play by the rules of fair trade. So we have to be mindful of the geopolitical implications of tariff additions and reductions. And ultimately, the president is just not going to expose American workers, particularly in the manufacturing sector, a sector that's done quite well in recent months and quarters, to unfair competition. So there are various stakeholders in play.
I have one last question about the CHIPS Act. So we know the CHIPS Act, the Senate just passed it. And we know for a lot of Taiwanese and South Korean companies, semiconductor companies investing in United States right now. But for those countries, semiconductor industry is also a high national interest and linked to the national security. So right now we see some people in Taiwan are worrying they're going to lose their edge to the world, including the United States, lose interest to protect its democracy if the global supply chain is constructed. So what is your approach when you're engaging with the Taiwanese companies to reassure that it's all right to work with the United States and bring the cutting edge chips to the United States?
Well, look, I mean, we used to provide about 40% of global computer chips. Now it's gone down to about 10%. In fact, some of the more high-tech chips that are essential for not just our cars and all of our machinery and tools, but for our national security. I think it was Secretary Raimondo pointed out there are 250 chips in a Javelin missile launcher. We get 90% of those chips, at least, from other countries, Taiwan in particular. So our national security in part depends on standing up a domestic semiconductor industry. We are an extremely open economy relative to all the rest when it comes to others coming here to build fabrication foundries, chip fabs, and we're very welcoming to anyone who wants to do so. You know that Intel, South Korea, as of yesterday, the Taiwanese have all talked about building factories here, and the president is very much open to that kind of investment. But the key fact is that we need to have a domestic supply source of these critically important chips, and this act is essential to make that happen.
以上就是今天节目的全部内容，感谢您的收看，我们明天再见。